From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson, along with Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And Tanya, we should explain right at the top, listeners may notice a little delay on the line when you speak because, like many Americans, because of coronavirus, you are working from home today.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Jeremy, you know, we're all taking this outbreak very seriously. It's why I'm actually hosting today from my closet. It's the quietest place in the house. But I'm doing this because of the possibility of exposure. A loved one of someone I work with attended a conference where there was a person who tested positive. And so it's important that we all take the necessary precautions.
But you are, of course, working from home and you've got kids at home as well.
I do. I have kids and school is still open, and we'll have actually a segment about that later today where we'll talk about whether or not you should keep your kids home or have them go to school and whether school districts should actually close schools. But yes, I am home hosting Here and Now from my closet.
All right. Well, we would look forward to hearing about that in a little bit and glad you're feeling well. Let's get to the news. Airports in Europe are jammed with travelers today as the clock ticks down to midnight tomorrow when President Trump's 30-day ban on foreign nationals traveling into the U.S. takes effect because of the coronavirus. On NBC's Today Show, Vice President Mike Pence says Americans will still be able to get home.
We're going to be screening and asking every American who returns from Europe over the next 30 days to self-quarantine for 14 days.
Joining us now is NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Tam, what more do we know about this travel ban? Because there were a lot of details left out when the president announced it.
Yeah, the way the president announced it was relatively inaccurate, and they've been cleaning it up since. Americans will still be able to travel from Europe. As they say, they will be screened and will need to self-quarantine. Also, green card holders and close relatives of Americans will also still continue to be able to travel from Europe. So it is not a straight-up travel ban, and for Americans who are in Europe, there is no need to rush to the airport to make it in before this deadline. Also, the UK is excluded.
The UK is excluded. A lot of people are wondering about that because, of course, Europeans could just go to the UK and then fly to the United States. What has been the reaction? Of course, we have to mention that the reaction on Wall Street has not been good. The markets had to stop trading for a bit this morning because they went down so quickly.
Yeah, the markets are still way down.
Right.
You know, in some ways, the everyone has moved on from this address. There were some inaccuracies in it, which is pretty remarkable for a televised address that is in a teleprompter and prepared in advance. But people are moving on over on Capitol Hill. They are working on a legislative package. There are negotiations going on. And public health officials are testifying on Capitol Hill as well.
And when you talk about the negotiations going on Capitol Hill, from just the headlines I've been seeing all day today, it doesn't look like those negotiations between the Republicans and the Democrats are going very well.
You know, it's very hard to tell. As someone who used to cover Congress and has watched high-stakes negotiations before, often it looks like it's going very badly, and then all of a sudden there's actually a deal. And President Trump, who was in the Oval Office, he said he didn't like the Democrats' plan or everything in it. But then when you sort of dig into what he's saying, there's nuance there. And he seems to be saying that there are parts of the Democrats' bill that he doesn't like. And we do know that administration officials are working with Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats, and negotiations are ongoing. Pelosi has said she thinks that this can be worked out very quickly.
What kind of economic help is the administration looking at, especially for people who are forced to stay at home because they're sick or quarantined?
Yeah, they are talking about paid sick leave, which is a pretty big development. President Trump even said that he wants to make sure that tipped workers are made whole or at least not too negatively affected. So there seems to be a fair bit of agreement on that part of it. There's also President Trump has asked for expanded Small Business Administration loans to help small businesses who are going to be negatively affected. The president was asked about potentially declaring an emergency to free up other federal funds and aid, and he says he's not quite there yet. One thing President Trump does want is a payroll tax holiday or relief from payroll taxes for some period of time. Both Democrats and Republicans on the Hill are not as sold on that as he is. And what he said in the Oval Office today was, well, you know, we may get that later.
The White House Task Force and the CDC have come out with specific guidelines for three communities hit hardest by outbreaks so far in the United States, Seattle, Santa Clara, California, and New Rochelle, New York. What do we know about those guidelines?
They are encouraging social distancing. They say that large events should be canceled. Small events should be postponed. People should keep space and keep distance and essentially just keep away from each other. And particularly for older Americans, they want nursing homes to stop all unnecessary visits to protect older Americans.
One more thing, Tam. The president has come in contact with people who later turns out came in contact with or had coronavirus themselves. He's still not planning to get tested, right?
We haven't heard any new developments on that. He was asked about an aide to Jair Bolsonaro, the Brazilian president who was visiting and was at Mar-a-Lago with the president this weekend. That aide tested positive for coronavirus. President Trump said he is not concerned.
Tamara Keith, NPR White House correspondent, thank you.
You're welcome.
And the S&P 500 dove again today following news of President Trump's travel ban. The ban affects most travel from the European Union, and it goes into effect this Friday. But already, some health experts are wondering if this is really a good idea. For more, let's bring in Helen Branswell. She writes about infectious diseases for the medical news publication STAT. Welcome.
Hi, Tanya.
So, Helen, your thoughts about this travel ban. Is it a good idea? Will it help?
Maybe. Maybe a little. Europe is lighting up. The numbers are rising in a number of countries there. I mean, Italy has had a big problem for a couple of weeks now, but France and Spain and Germany, the numbers are climbing. So, it is a concern. But closing the doors to Europe sort of predisposes that what's on the other side of the closed door is coronavirus free, and that's simply not the case. There's lots of it in the country already, and so it's not like this is going to throw up a force field around the United States.
And you bring up a good point that we can't state enough, and that's the fact that we really don't know the number of cases here in the United States because we have not tested as extensively as places like Italy.
Right. So, I'm just looking at a dashboard that the Johns Hopkins University is maintaining, sort of showing cases around the world. And the United States has fewer cases than Germany, France, and Spain, but, it's not that much different. And that's with very little testing going on. We're labs and around the country able to test as many people as they could, the numbers might look entirely different.
What do we know from history? Has there been other outbreaks where we saw travel restrictions either work or fail?
Sure. So, in 2003, people might remember the SARS outbreak. I was based in Toronto then, and Toronto was one of the places that had a major outbreak. Transmission of the virus from person to person was stopped and it effectively melted back into nature. And one of the reasons it could be contained was because travel dropped off. But another was that people who contracted SARS weren't really infectious until a few days into their illness. That's not the case with this virus. With this virus, people are infectious really from the point where they start to develop symptoms and maybe even for hours, a day or so beforehand. So containing something like this is very, very difficult. And using the SARS model here would not really be a good approach to take. It's just not the same bug at all.
Hmm. We should mention that the U.S. isn't the only country limiting travel from abroad. Australia, Japan, and Italy have all put into place restrictions too. If we know they're not that effective, why do countries keep trying them?
Well, part of it's about buying time. One of the goals is to slow things down. And so if you can slow down the rate at which the wave of cases hits your hospital systems, if you can make that wave smaller in any kind of way, that is helpful. That helps your systems to cope. There was just a recent study published in the journal Science by researchers at Northeastern University in Boston. They looked at the issue of travel restrictions from China, and what they concluded was they only buy a little bit of time, but if you layer them with public health measures, things like canceling mass gatherings, telling people to telework if they can, closing schools if that's an effective tool, that the jury on that one is still out, that you know, the combination of the two, the synergy of the two, could really have an impact. But here we're not yet seeing sort of an attempt to link those travel restrictions with aggressive public health measures on the ground in multiple parts of the country.
That's Helen Branswell. She writes about infectious diseases for STAT. Thank you so much for taking the time with us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
On a secret military recording, a sound so haunting, one scientist believed it could change the world.
My mind was racing as I listened to this, and I thought, this is the way.
Join NPR's Invisibilia for the first episode of our new season.
The game tonight has been postponed. You're all safe.
That was the sound last night just before tip-off in Oklahoma City, where the Utah Jazz and the Thunder were about to play. The NBA just announcing at that moment that it was suspending its season because a Utah Jazz player, Rudy Gobert, had tested positive for COVID-19. The NCAA also says its March Madness basketball tournament games will be played without fans. Other sporting events are either being canceled or will be played without fans as well. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, have we ever seen anything like this before?
Not on this scale. There was a measles outbreak in 1989, and a conference tournament here and there was canceled. And, of course, in Europe, a lot of the soccer matches, football matches, and other sporting events have been canceled. But the United States sporting community was fairly reluctant, I would say, to follow the best practices. And, in fact, in some cases, the Golden State Warriors were asked a couple days ago not to play their game against the Clippers. They declined that request until the request for the next game was made explicit. There will be no Warriors game at the Chase Center in San Francisco, but that dictum was subsumed by the overall suspension of the NBA season, and we don't know how long it's going to take, but we know if a quarantine is 14 weeks and 14 days, and Rudy Gobert's, thank you, Jazz teammates, well, at least one of them was also exposed. It's been reported that I can't see it starting again for another 2 weeks.
That Jazz player who's tested positive for COVID-19 is Donovan Mitchell of the Jazz.
Yep.
I was at the Celtics Jazz game last Friday. Gobert was there, probably touched most of the players. This could get a lot worse.
Well, he banged bodies with the big Celtic center, Tice, you know, 50-something times, according to pretty accurate stat counts. That doesn't mean it was transferred. It just had a lot of contact. Then again, he's had a lot of contact with his Jazz teammates, and all of them tested negative, except for Mitchell. Mitchell has a locker right next to Gobert. There's still a lot about transmission we don't know, but since March 2nd, the Jazz have played the Knicks, the Jazz have played the Raptors, you take on the Celtics, the Detroit Pistons, you take all those teams, you see who they've played, you also add into it the fact that referees, so there are NBA personnel who have had contact with Rudy Gobert and the Jazz players. In fact, that's why they canceled the Kings against Pelicans game last night, because a referee who reffed a Jazz game was scheduled to ref that game. That was to be the last game. It was 10:30 Eastern tip-off time. That was to be the last game of the NBA season until the suspension, but then they shut that game down too. So in a way, it's a microcosm of how these vectors of contagion might spread, and you get the sense of someone who came into contact with someone else who came into contact, and you see, based on the NBA and people we know and people whose names we know, you see how this thing can potentially spread.
Well, and what about other sporting events? The PGA Tour today banned spectators from attending tournaments through April 5th. What about Major League Baseball? What about the NHL?
Yeah, it seems, first of all, I would say that golf is in a very different category because the players don't have to come within a meter of each other or really anywhere near each other. You have an odd scene of right now, the Big East tournament is being played. There is a game going on right now. It's not in front of fans, but then you have the SEC, the American Conference. You have I want to check this. Yes, the Atlantic 10, all being canceled. So there is a little bit of a mixed message. And sometimes we're talking about arenas that are within miles of each other. Mm-hmm. So there doesn't necessarily seem to be a clear public health best practices that is always being adhered to by all the conferences. That, and I don't want to sidestep your question on the pro sports leagues. It makes no sense if the NBA is canceled this season. Sure, someone in the NBA got coronavirus, but they share arenas with NHL teams. And the big question isn't really if one or two people on the team got it. Experts say that there's going to be widespread infection in the community. The question seems to be mass gatherings. And so you have the invitation to come to this game and join 20,000 people. That seems a lot more dangerous than the, you know, 12 to on an NHL roster, 20-something players who are actually participating in the events.
Just real quick, the Olympics coming up this summer in Japan.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seemed unthinkable that you'd either have the Olympics without spectators or that you'd have the Olympics canceled. Japan is a source, one of the major right. countries that have been dealing with this. They're looking at it, and they haven't made an announcement yet.
Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Today, school districts throughout the country are assessing whether to close public schools. Some of the hardest hit areas like Seattle have made this decision, but thousands more are still in session. To talk more about this is Professor Ashish Jha. He's a professor of global health at Harvard School of Public Health. Professor, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So many school districts have already decided to cancel large-scale activities like sports games and night events. I actually received a memo in my son's backpack last night, but classes are still in session for many of them. And I'm just wondering from you, should education officials close schools to prevent the spread of coronavirus?
Yeah, you know, this is a really tough call because while I feel very strongly that we have to close all other types of public events, sporting events, large gatherings. Schools are complicated because, you know, if you close schools, that means parents can't go to work. It means a lot of kids won't get access to nutrition because they get free lunch and breakfast. So I understand that this is a really difficult decision for schools to make. But if we're really focused on reducing the spread of the virus, we probably should be moving towards closing all the schools.
Yes, because I'm thinking about that, those complicated factors, like, as you said, kids who depend on school for hot meals. But at the same time, if we're talking about social distancing, kids gather in these spaces, there are large groups of them. They're in contact with adults as well. And so all of this is so complicated, as you said.
Yeah, it is very complicated. You know, and kids do get infections. We've seen in other countries, kids get infected with coronavirus. The good news is they generally tend not to get very sick. But the bad news is they can spread it. They can spread it to their parents. They can spread it to their grandparents. So if we're going to slow the virus down, we probably have to be moving towards closing, you know, primary and secondary schools.
How helpful are temporary closures or even these deep cleaning measures that some schools are implementing?
Yeah, right now, the problem across America is because of the fiasco around testing and the fact that we still can't test people who have symptoms, we don't know how much coronavirus there is in the community. So school districts, when they identify a case, are doing these temporary closures and deep cleanings. I think that probably helps a little. But we have to remember that that's in the context of probably a lot more infection out there than we're seeing and that we're identifying.
The NBA announced it's suspending games for the rest of the season. I think some folks are a little confused about outdoor activities as well. Many schools have sports activities that are outdoors. What do you say to that if districts are still considering whether or not to continue those types of activities?
Yeah, I think anytime you have large numbers of people gathering, parents, kids, it's probably a bad idea, and we need to move towards canceling those events. I'm not sure that being outdoors helps that much. If people are coming in close contact with each other, they're still spreading the virus. And so whether it's indoor or outdoors, if you're going to end up bringing people together and they're going to be in close contact with each other, standing next to each other, then we're going to increase the spread of the virus. And our health system just can't handle that right now. And so we really need to think seriously about canceling all of those activities.
Professor, should parents keep their kids home from school?
Yeah, so it's, you know, as a parent of three kids who go to, you know, primary and secondary schools, it's a very hard question to answer. I think right now, if you're not in a high-risk situation, if you don't have somebody who's elderly living at home, it's probably okay to continue to send your kids to school, obviously assuming that there aren't outbreaks in your community. But I think we need to just encourage school officials to think hard about whether it makes sense to continue to hold schools in person. And my feeling is either now or within the next couple of weeks, we're probably going to end up seeing all the schools across the country close, at least temporarily.
And Professor, you've been thinking about the major takeaways that you want the national public to think about as we try to protect ourselves from this coronavirus.
Yeah, you know, we are really in the middle of an unprecedented public health crisis. And the way we're going to get through this is if all of us work together. And there are a few principles that everybody needs to engage in. First is this idea of social distancing. I think we have to avoid crowds. We have to cancel public events. We've been talking about schools and offices. I think those ultimately need to be closed to avoid people coming together. I can't emphasize enough the importance of hand washing. Washing your hands with soap and water, using Purell if you don't have soap and water, you know, and then if you do start getting any symptoms, start feeling sick, staying away from others until you can get, you know, a diagnosis, until you feel better, avoiding contacts with others is going to be critical. If we do all of these things, and they feel painful, but if we do all of these things, we're going to get through this period and we're going to come out on the other side okay, but we're all going to have to work on this.
That's Professor Ashish Jha. He's with Harvard School of Public Health. Thank you so much for taking this time.
It was nice chatting with you.
There are questions about whether pets can spread the coronavirus. After news last week that a pet dog in Hong Kong contracted the virus, though officials called the case mild. Let's bring in Scott Weiss, who's a professor at the University of Guelph's Ontario Veterinary College. Scott, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So is there evidence that dogs and cats can get this virus?
Well, it hasn't been looked at very much. There's a dog in Hong Kong that's had a series of positive tests, which would strongly support the dog was infected. He was healthy, which is good, but it gives us indication that some animals might be infected. This is a virus that's thought to have started off in an animal and then moved into people. And the big question right now is how effectively can it move back to animals, or is it basically a human virus at this point?
Well, and then if it were to move back to animals, could it then move back to people? Could people get it through pets?
Well, that's a concern. Is it something that's just spreading human to human, or is it almost always spreading human to human and there might be an animal source? So what we're concerned about is someone's infected and we're trying to contain them. They're at home under self-isolation, but they've got a dog or a cat. And if that cat gets exposed and then takes it outside, is that a way the virus can escape some of the containment? So it's much less of an issue in animals than it is people as far as we know, but it's a big enough problem. We want to cover all our bases.
What would the symptoms be if, let's say, a dog had coronavirus?
Well, we don't really know. This dog in Hong Kong is normal. So just like in people, some people that have this virus don't have any signs of disease. So does this mean no dogs get sick, or it just happened to be this dog? We don't know. If they get sick, it's probably very similar to what we would get in a respiratory disease, and would usually be mild.
If a person gets coronavirus, should they be worried about transmitting it to their pet? Should they stay away from their pet?
Well, I'm not sure it's worried, but it's aware. So if someone has coronavirus, what we want to do is keep them away from, you know, everything and everyone, and that includes animals and people. So we want to stay away from people so they don't infect other people, and we can keep them away from their pets and other animals at the same time. If they've already been exposed to their animal, so if I've been exposed and I've been sick and I've been in the house with my dog and my cat, I've already exposed them. So then the logical thing is keep them inside, keep them with me so they don't spread it anywhere else. It's some very simple things that we can do to reduce any risk if there is some risk.
Keep them quarantined with you if you're quarantined.
Yeah, it's treat your dog and your cat like you're supposed to your kids. So if you've exposed someone and they want all of you to stay isolated, well, let's include all of them, to include pets that are in the household with you.
Are there other viruses that we pass on to our pets, or other sicknesses that move back and forth between humans and animals?
Well, there are a lot of things that we can move back and forth, and that's what we call zoonotic infections. I mean, bacteria and fungi and viruses, and some come mainly from animals to people, and there's some that go person to animal. And our flu is an example of that. So human flu, we can infect the dog. So if I have influenza and I cough my dog or he licks my contaminated hands, there's a really low chance he'll get flu, but it's possible. And we call them dead-end hosts because they get infected and they don't spread the virus anymore. So the question we have with this virus is, this dog that's infected just a dead-end host? So we can infect animals periodically, but they don't infect someone else. Or can they be infectious and pass it on, like some of the things that we move back and forth, and we keep moving it back and forth?
That is Scott Weiss, who's a professor at the University of Guelph's Ontario Veterinary College. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Today, the public is expected to start receiving official instructions in the mail on how to fill out the 2020 census. It's the culmination of more than a decade's worth of planning. But there are complications. This national headcount is officially rolling out just as we're right in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang has been covering this process, and we wanted to check in with him on the latest about all that's being done for this national count. Hansi joins us from New York. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tanya.
So, Hansi, this is the first census that will be conducted primarily online, and that alone makes it unique. But it's also rolling out nationwide during this public health crisis, as I mentioned. How is the coronavirus affecting the Bureau's preparations?
Well, it's certainly complicating things for the Census Bureau that's already trying to prepare for technical changes. And right now, the Bureau says it is monitoring the situation very closely, and it is prepared to change its plans in any areas that are affected by a coronavirus outbreak, possibly delaying sending out census workers later on this year. But the main message the Census Bureau is sending right now is to encourage every household in the country to do the census on their own with minimal to no physical contact, because you can go to my2020census.gov. You can call a toll-free number, or you can fill out a paper form if you receive one, and that requires no contact, a physical contact with a Census Bureau person.
Can you remind us why every household is legally required to participate?
This is a constitutional mandate. If we look back at Article 1, Section 2, and then that's connected with the 14th Amendment, the Constitution requires a headcount of every person living in the country once every 10 years. The country has done this since 1790. And those numbers determine how many congressional seats and electoral college votes each state gets. So this is about how the country divides up power based on population. And that's population of every resident living in the country, regardless of citizenship status, regardless of immigration status. And these numbers are also used to distribute an estimated $1.5 trillion a year in funding for healthcare, Medicare, Medicaid, schools, roads. This is foundational information for the government, for businesses when they decide where to open up supermarkets. And there are laws that require every household to participate in the census.
Yeah, you mentioned immigration status, and we talked quite a bit about that when the subject of whether you are a U.S. citizen would come up on the census. It is not. But what is the Bureau trying to do to reach maybe those populations who do not have the documentation?
And just to be clear, that now blocked citizenship question did not ask about a person's immigration status. It only asked if a person was a U.S. citizen or not and how they gained that citizenship. But again, that question, like you said, is permanently blocked from being added to the 2020 census forms. But the Bureau has a major challenge of how to reach unauthorized immigrants, and the Bureau is under a legal mandate to count every person living in the country. And so it is trying to partner with local organizations, community groups with existing ties, what the Bureau calls trusted voices, because the Bureau understands that hearing a message from the government that you should be counted is not going to be as effective as hearing it from a local community leader, maybe your pastor, someone that you trust that you interact with daily to help explain how this information could be beneficial. There's one thing very important to point out. which is there's a lot of fear amongst folks about how the government could misuse this information. And it's important to remember that federal law prohibits the Census Bureau from releasing information identifying individuals for 72 years. The question is, will people trust the Trump administration to uphold those laws at a time where there's a lot of concern with increased immigration enforcement?
Hansi, what about some of those other historically undercounted groups like communities of color?
There are specific challenges. For example, language access. The Bureau is allowing folks to respond to the census in 13 languages, but there are some languages that are not included. And so community groups are stepping up and trying to produce translations in languages that are not supported by the Census Bureau on their census forms. You know, another group that is undercounted as young children under the age of 5. One factor is that some children live in multiple homes, and so some families aren't quite sure where to count the children. And so this time around, the Census Bureau is adding extra languages prompts on the forms to encourage people, to remind people to make sure to note if there are any young children living in the household to make sure they are counted as well.
You mentioned time will tell in the next couple of weeks, those outreach efforts, whether or not the coronavirus will impact those efforts. But are you hearing in any way from the Bureau that they are making any immediate changes?
At this point, the Bureau says it's not making any major operational changes. But one thing to keep in mind here is that we're hearing reports that a lot of colleges and universities are making changes to class schedules. Some are asking students to leave their dormitories. And this has raised a big question of where college students should be counted for the census. The Census Bureau has confirmed to NPR that students living away from home should still be counted at their colleges, the location of their colleges, even if they are temporarily staying somewhere else because of the outbreak. The general rule for every person living in the country of where you should be counted for the census, it's where you usually live and sleep, regardless of where you are on April 1st. General rule there.
That's NPR's Hansi Lo Wong. Thank you so much for this update, Hansi.
You're welcome, Tanya.
There are now nearly 1,300 people in the U.S. who have tested positive for coronavirus, and to avoid being infected, people are being advised to thoroughly and frequently wash hands, disinfect high-touch surfaces like doorknobs, cover coughs and sneezes, and yes, it's not too late. Get a flu shot. Sarah Bowden from member station WESA in Pittsburgh explains why, in an age of the coronavirus, that's just a good idea.
Jan Rather says his pharmacist laughed at him when he went to get a flu shot last week.
The pharmacist kind of looked at his watch and was like, dude, it's March. Like, I think your chances of getting the flu at this point are as low as your chances of getting coronavirus.
Flu season is winding down, but data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show that people are still contracting the virus. Here in Allegheny County, which has a population of more than 1.2 million people, at least a dozen residents have died from flu-related illnesses this season. That number might go up, as was the case last year. Public health experts say right now many Americans, including those in the Pittsburgh area, are more likely to get the flu than COVID-19, the disease caused by coronavirus. Now that there are confirmed cases here in Pennsylvania, that eventually may change. The majority of COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. have been in the Seattle area. Patty Hayes is the public health director of King County, Washington, where Seattle's located. She says the region's healthcare system is under incredible stress.
We need to slow the spread of disease to the point where our healthcare system can continue to be able to handle the load.
Dr. Luann Brink is the chief epidemiologist at the Allegheny County Health Department, which has been preparing for possible coronavirus outbreaks. She says the treatments for both COVID-19 and influenza are similar. For example, someone hospitalized with either illness might be put on a ventilator.
And we want to make sure that those systems are available should a coronavirus, a novel coronavirus outbreak hit here, so that we can have those resources available and we won't have to go to surge capacity on those hospital beds.
The more people vaccinated against the flu, the less the disease spreads, and the more medical resources are available to potential patients with coronavirus, which has no vaccine.
And it's also important that we're able to discern those two viruses from one another. So increasing the proportion of individuals who are vaccinated against influenza would help in that effort.
COVID-19 and the flu have similar symptoms, including cough and fever. Let's say you develop these symptoms. Because COVID-19 is sometimes fatal, you go to the doctor, and it turns out to be the flu. You've just stressed yourself out and consumed medical resources at a time when healthcare workers are stretched thin. Of course, some people still get the flu even after getting inoculated. This year, preliminary estimates find that the vaccine is just 45% effective at preventing illness. But Dr. Tom Walsh, an infectious disease physician at Allegheny Health Network, says people should get vaccinated regardless.
Even when it does not completely prevent influenza illness, it minimizes the damage that it can cause. So potentially instead of dying from influenza, you may have a mild illness from the influenza.
And are less likely to need medical attention. For Here and Now, I'm Sarah Bowden in Pittsburgh.
For the second time this week, a precipitous drop in stocks this morning triggered the circuit breakers at the New York Stock Exchange, bringing trading to a halt for 15 minutes. Joining us now is Julie Niemann, who is an analyst at Smithmore & Company in St. Louis. Julie, welcome back. And what are you making of the turmoil we're seeing in the markets right now?
This is a market that has had huge knock-on effects. Probably the biggest thing you have to remember that this is not a replay of 2007, 8, and 9. This is entirely different. What we have here is a monstrously illiquid market that's seeing a big sell-off just due to the effects that have been blowing up over the years and growing over the years.
But you say that this is not like 2007, 8, and 9. Why do you say that?
The economy actually has been okay, and it still is okay. Are we going to experience a recession? Well, sure, a lot of this can cause a recession. But this is not a collapse in any single system as far as the economy is concerned. This is going to be more of a deliverability problem. And it's not going to be a severe recession. It's going to be one of these nice V-shaped recessions, if there is such a thing as a nice recession, but something from which we can recover on a fairly speedy fashion, simply because this is not something that has affected the system. The financial system, the market system, is broken, but the market system has been broken for some time. And this is all due to a huge number of financial derivatives out there, derivatives on derivatives, which has made markets very illiquid. You have packaged financial products. They offer diversity, but when you sell that product, all of these internal units are affected as well, and you end up with kind of a spiral. So it's become a market of sell, 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 but there are no buyers out there because of the financial products.
Well, how long is that going to last, do you think?
Because the size of it is so enormous. We're talking trillions of dollars of financial derivatives that are impacting the stock market, the bond market, virtually everything. These are things that are going to experience fails, that are going to experience problems with unwinding liquidity problems, and it is going to have to play its way out. I wish I could tell you when I hear a thud, but unfortunately, the selling can continue. 80% of all the trading on the New York Stock Exchange right now is done by computer algorithms. It's untouched by human hands. So this is a market that has a life of its own. And as they found out earlier, it's the circuit breaker. You unplug it, and that's the only thing that stops it. What investors cannot do is panic on this. This is not, again, 2008-9, though recovery there was very slow, very long. And honestly, we really did not have a good recovery. There was so much damage done to the global financial system. So we had a weak recovery, a long recovery, and now we're seeing where the chinks in the armor happen to be.
But there are a lot of people who are not worried about necessarily their investments, but their jobs, that they may not be able to go to work for a while, that they may not have the kind of job where they have paid sick leave. Isn't that going to ripple through the economy in a powerful way?
That's where fiscal policy has to step in. Because of the recovery from the 2008-9, what I call a depression, not a recession, people are now working in the gig economy. They are not working for corporations to where you get unemployment benefits. You're independent contractors, and we see these absolutely everywhere. These are the folks who do not have a safety net. There is no good transmission mechanism to get income to them when you've got a period of not having any income going in. This is something that the fine minds in Washington and elsewhere can figure out. There is going to have to be some way to get those temporary savings or some kind of paycheck into people's hands to keep them from basically running into these problems. The obvious system is going through the unemployment offices, where we can man those up, get checks out to people, redefining what unemployment insurance is. That would be the most effective transmission system right there. But that is what you have to do, is get income into the hands of people who are living week-to-week paychecks. These are service workers, restaurant workers, healthcare workers that basically don't have any kind of backup system.
Julie, many people are looking at this and saying, yes, there may need to be an economic stimulus, a fiscal stimulus to deal with this, but also the government is just going to have to show that it can actually handle the health crisis, give people confidence in that first, and that will start to fix these problems.
And when you decimate the entire budget of the CDC and the NIH, what do you expect? That's what's been going on in government for the last 3 years. All of the regulatory and agencies have had their budgets absolutely slashed, so they can't do their jobs. This is a grasp of the obvious. Now you have to flood them with the money, but it is still going to take time to ramp back up because you've lost scientists, you've lost capable administrators, you've lost people who get the job done and had to go into private industry to find other things to do. So it's going to be a rebuilding process, and that takes time. So the really unfortunate situation here is there is no quick fix here.
That is Julie Niemann, who is an analyst at Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis. Julie, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. The U.S. Census is underway, and the results will be used to redraw congressional maps around the country. In Colorado, a new commission will try to make sure that process isn't driven by politics.
Nobody who's worked for an elected official can apply. No lobbyists, no people who have been employed by one of the major political parties.
That's next time on Here and Now.